Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, this is MJ Network. This is Fran Lewis, and we're going to talk about, I hope right now, we're going to talk about Second Story Man, and Charles Salzberg is here. Hi, Charles. How you doing?
Fine, thanks, and thanks for asking me back again, Fran.
Oh, I'm excited that you're here. It's just that I'm so glad you're here because sometimes the system doesn't like people today. I don't know why. But I have to tell you, I'm lucky that Optimum Online has been working, and they've been pretty good through all the Psalms and everything. So we're going to talk about his book, and this is MJ Network, in memory of my sister, Marcia Joyce, who conned me into doing this, and boy, am I glad I did. The Second Story Man was very interesting. I'm going to talk about a couple of concepts. Francis Hoyt, arrogant, athletic, brilliant, manipulative, and ruthless, my kind of person, is a master burglar. He specializes in stealing high-end silver, breaking into homes that seem impenetrable. He's really good. He's never been caught in the act, and we're not going to tell you if he gets caught now. But we've got Charles Floyd, one of my other favorite characters from a previous book, and Manny Perez, and the author of Second Story Man, is told in alternating chapters, so I got to know all of them. So tell us, readers, a little bit about this Francis Hoyt and the backstory that now you created him, because he's a really cool character.
Thank you. Well, it's funny, Fran. I don't know, maybe 7, 8, maybe even 10 years ago. It's amazing how something sticks with you. I read in a piece in the New Yorker called "The Silver Thief," and it was about this the guy named Blaine Nordahl, who was a master burglar. And for some reason, that stuck in my mind. I didn't think about it very much, but when it came time to starting a new book, I thought, you know, this is really fascinating. This guy who had a special talent, which was for breaking into people's homes. And so I went back and I read the article again, and I thought, you know, I think I can use part of his life or part of what he did for a character. As you probably know, because you've read all my books, I think, I don't really do murder mm-hmm. mystery or murder per se. I write about other kinds of crimes because I think they're more interesting to me. I mean, you know, if you want murder, there's so many, you know, detective novels out there and TV shows. And so I started with the idea of creating a master burglar who is the best in the business. And if you want to know why he's the best, just ask him. He's very arrogant, and he really thinks of himself that way. That's what he prides himself on, is that he's the best. And it occurred to me that, for me, this is one of the problems, a very American problem, which is that we have to be the best. We have to mm-hmm. be winners. And so I wanted to use that theme in the book. And so that's really how the idea came to me and how I started.
Well, he must have known my mother, because my mother always believed you have to be the best, you have to be perfect, and it has to be right the first time, or you're going to do it over again.
Right, and that's a burden and to people, right?
Don't I know it? Don't I know it? Yeah. All my life, if I didn't have a perfect test, I had to write it over, even if I got 99.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. Oh, yeah, it's hard. So explain the title, Second Story Man, which I thought was really cool, and why Hoyt realizes that the second floor is not where he will be robbing anymore.
Right. Well, that's a very common term for a burglar, a second story
mm-hmm.
man, because usually mm-hmm. The valuables are on the second floor, in the bedroom, you know, jewelry, watches, stuff like that. And often, if there's a safe, it's probably going to be upstairs rather than downstairs. That's really how he starts his career, which is breaking into homes and going up to that second floor to steal the valuables. But to me, it had a more important meaning, the title, or second meaning, and that is in the terms of story. You know, everyone's mm-hmm. got a first story, and often we have a second story, a second life, you know, people who start off one way and then wind up another way.
Mm-hmm.
And so it had a dual meaning for me. You know, all three characters here are about to embark on a second life. Charlie Floyd has just recently retired. Manny Perez is on suspension. He's a Miami police detective. And so all of them are really starting second stories now. And so that's why I thought the title was appropriate.
Well, I think I got that part. when I wrote the review, this is really a great book. And how come I want to change? I have my questions in front of me, but I've been asking this to a lot of different people because you know how many books I read, too many.
Yes.
And everybody knows I get eye strain every single day of the week.
Uh-huh.
And I've read some really good ones recently, and I've read some, well, not such good ones. But so why is it that some authors write in different voices? How did you decide to write in the different voices of the different characters?
It sort of came naturally. I wanted to tell, for a writer, at least for me, if I can tell it in the first person, it's easier for me to get into the head of of the character and to sort of see what motivates them. I'm really interested in that in life, but in literature too, is getting as close to the character as I can. And so that's why I prefer first person, and that's why I do these different voices. And the other thing is, it's a bit of a challenge. You can kind of lose yourself in a different voice. And the biggest fear for anyone who does this, and certainly for me, is that the characters are going to sound alike. And that's a real problem they do. And so I work very hard to create a different language and a different tone for each of the characters so that you can distinguish it, so that you could pick up the book and open to any place in the book and not see the name of the person who's speaking, but you would know right away which character you're reading about.
Well, I can tell that. I could tell when Manny was speaking. I could tell the arrogance in Francis Hoyt. I like that character, though. And Floyd. And I could tell his frustrations, too. I could tell his frustrations. Sometimes the villain is your favorite character for whatever reason.
Absolutely, and I'm kind of with you. And that happens to writers, too. I started this, and I thought that Charlie Floyd and Manny Perez would be my favorite characters, but it just sometimes they take over. And Floyd, as bad as he is, as conniving, as manipulative as he is, there's something that attracts me to him. And I hate to say it, it's like if you have kids saying, who's your favorite character? But he turned out to be my favorite character.
See, I told you. I see these things. He's sort of like, he doesn't hurt anybody, so you can't hate him. And
right. Well,
he's just doing
anyone.
It. He hasn't hurt anyone, you know, physically. He just robbed them, poor thing.
Shuns violence.
Yeah. Well, he's really good. So how did he become a thief? And how come, and this was the good part, because you know how many books Fran reads, how did was he able to leave no prints or anything after robbing the house that it would take the person a while to say, oh, my God, I'm missing that?
He's a master at it, and he has thought out everything beforehand. Every time he's ready to break into a home, he has studied, he has researched, he knows the layout of the house, he knows where everything is, he knows where he knows the patterns of the people who live in that house, he knows when they go to sleep, he knows when they're away, he wears gloves, he's very aware that you can leave hairs without even realizing it. And so because he's thought of everything, he's able to anticipate what can get him caught. And so that's what makes him so good in my mind, is that he thinks ahead. It's kind of like, I played a lot of ball when I was a kid, and one of the things that you could tell the standout players, for instance, in baseball, is because they're out in the field. This is what they're thinking. What am I going to do if the ball is hit to me? What am I going to do with it? What base am I going to throw it to? How many outs? They have to think about the entire game in those split seconds before the pitch comes in and the ball is hit. And that's very much like he is. like Francis Hoyt. He has thought of everything.
Well, it sounds like my nephew Jake when he plays baseball. Well, I think he's been trained by my brother. You never know. What can I say?
A lot of people don't play, Fran, aren't aware that all these games, there's as much mental preparation as there is physical.
Oh, yeah. On my hand, I played punch ball, and I was really good at punching, but I couldn't run. So my dad let me stand on the side and keep score, but when they needed somebody to clean the bases, they knew who it was. So I always got a home run, so I never had to run. I was like a klutz, so I ran. I just walked around the bases and skipped and said, "See, I told you." And
right.
You know,
but you
I cleaned them off.
You had a particular skill.
I had a good skill. I still have that same skill. And so, how does he decide? He decides which houses, and how does he justify his actions? Because I'm listening to him saying, "Well, you know, they don't really need this. Blah blah blah. I'm going to rob them." And I'm going to say, "Yeah, not a bad idea for a living if you don't get caught." So, how does he justify the fact that he can do this?
Which makes
him even more fun.
Yeah, I mean, I think everyone has to justify their actions to themselves, and he justifies it is by saying, "Look, these people have a lot of money. A lot of them inherited the money. They have much more than they can ever use, and they've spent it on something that's really not of any particular use. In other words, it's not like a car, which is, well, we're talking about silver, which just looks nice, which makes you feel good if you own things that are valuable." And so that's his justification in his own head. It wouldn't occur to him that, look, this is mine, not yours, and you have no right to take it. It's just that's his pattern of thinking, and a lot of it comes from his upbringing.
Well, you know, it's funny because you listen to the news sometimes, and you listen to these young kids that rob, and they say, "Well, you know, I don't have anything, so why should I take something that doesn't belong to me?" And that's sad. I mean, I taught for a million years. My students would never do something like that. For the one or two that got caught in other classes, they paid the penalty. Well, you know, I didn't think the teacher would notice and go, "Well, obviously, when her keys were missing to her car, this is a true story, she might have noticed that she would drive home."
That's
right. I said, "What were you going to do?" Yeah, the teacher drove a Lexus, and he says, "Well, she's so rich, she can buy another one." I said, "It's a sad fact that I caught you. What can I tell you?"
And that's a perfect example. If that kid stole that car, that teacher couldn't get home that day. So there were consequences to that. But if someone stole that teacher's silver, the next day their life is not going to be any different other than that they have been violated, which is very important. And that's something that he doesn't really... But the other thing is, for him, the violation is fine because he's an angry person. Mm. And he feels he's gotten the short end of the stick. So if someone suffers because of what he's done, breaking into their house, that's okay with him.
Yeah, I know. He's got no remorse, nothing. It helps not to have any empathy, too. Tell us why Manny Lopez hooked up with Charlie Floyd to catch this guy. And Floyd was retired, and Lopez was suspended. So they sort of made like a Felix Unger, an Oscar Madison kind of team from The Odd Couple, you might say.
Right. No, they are. Well, Manny Perez is, to me, an interesting character. Manny Perez, and you know this because you read Devil in the Hole, both Charlie Floyd and Manny Perez appear in an earlier book. Manny Perez has a tiny little part in Devil in the Hole. He appears only in one chapter and briefly in that chapter. But to me, again, sometimes when this is true of everyone, but certainly with writers, things stick in your head. And for some reason, Manny Perez, even though he was a tiny character, and I didn't really think him out that much in For Devil in the Hole, he stuck in my mind. And when I knew that I was going to use Charlie Floyd, who has a much bigger part in Devil in the Hole, in this book, I thought, you know, I need a foil for him, just what you were alluding to. I need someone else. And it popped into my head that he'd worked briefly with Manny Perez before. What if I team these two guys up? And it worked, I think, because they're very opposite.
That's exactly why it worked, because if they were two alike and two the same and thought the same way, I probably would have gotten, like, so what? you have to have confrontation and you have to have differences. Otherwise, the book gets like, oh, it's just like the other one I just read 6 weeks ago last Wednesday, which is not good. And everybody knows that my reviews are never negative. And lately, you know, to be very honest, if I don't like the book and if it's not worth 3 stars, I don't review it. I just write a summary and I won't post it anywhere. Because I don't feel it's my place. Yeah, doesn't that sound strange? Yeah, I've gotten a few, and a couple of them I got from Cheryl from Partners in Crime, who keeps me in my crime things here. And once or twice I don't answer to say I want to read the book because it doesn't interest me. And then she tells me that the author wants an interview and she's already scheduled it. I go, wait a minute, what about me? Don't I have a word about him? No. And the last couple of books, I just said to her, I'm just being nice because I really didn't like the story. So they're not going to know it.
Right, but that shows that you have a lot of integrity and you have empathy too, because I was a reviewer for a long time, and I think that's a really interesting and good solution you've drawn from this. Is you don't want to write something nice about a book that you didn't like, and yet you want to be supportive of the author. So I think you've come up with the perfect solution to that quandary.
Yeah, I just write a summary, and then I don't write whether I like or not. And then if the author says, did you like it, I write it was interesting. You know,
right.
I don't want to insult someone, but they figure it out. And then, of course, if they send me, you know, the next title, I would say I'm very busy, I'm going to pass on this one. I mean,
right.
I think the worst thing that ever happened, be honest, is that, and I don't understand why this girl just got an award for one of her books, is that there were 750 typos and 27 pages repeated, and I tried to explain to the person that I wasn't going to even write a summary, that I was waiting for her to have it re-edited, and she couldn't understand why I didn't give it 5 stars, at which point I said to her, think about it. Yeah. So Manny both has hooked up with him, so tell us, how they differed in their way to investigate the crime. One was so methodical, and the other one was so different.
Right, right. Manny is very methodical, and Floyd is much more gut-oriented, seat of the pants kind of thing. And and they work well together because of that. Because, I mean, as you pointed out, you need conflict. Without conflict in a novel, there is no novel. And so even though these were allied, they are very different, and yet they understand each other's differences, and they make it work for them. Manny is very precise. He is got a lot of honor. There are certain things that he won't do that he finds that they're unethical. Whereas Floyd will push the envelope a little bit more. In many ways, Floyd is much closer to Hoyt than he is to Manny. In a way, Francis Hoyt and Charlie Floyd are opposite sides of the coin. The difference is that Floyd is upholding the law and Hoyt is breaking the law, whereas Manny is much more of a straight arrow.
You know, I think everyone in the world, I shouldn't say this, always wants to see what happens if I do the wrong thing. I'm going to get caught.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. I once asked my mother the difference between me and my brother, and this is what she said. If I tell you to stop that or else, you will stop. If I tell that to your brother, he will say, or else what? And it's just what you're saying is it's about, okay, what's going to happen if I do this? Am I going to get caught? And you know, what's going to be the punishment, if any, if I'm caught? So I think there are two kinds of people, the people who just when you say.
Yeah, you're right.
Or the people who ask, okay, they weigh the consequences.
Well, that's for after teaching for 1,000 years. My sister did, not all the time. She pushed the envelope, and she would get in trouble, and I would know, and I would never tell because, you know, sisters don't tell on each other, and I miss her. She drove me crazy, but my mother never yelled, raised her voice, or hit. She just gave you the Ruthie look. You knew you were dead. That was it. Even if and how she always knew, and I never did anything really wrong, ever. You didn't get 100 on your test, now where is it? So I got 99.5, and she would say, you got to write it over. I go, what about just the one I got wrong? Nope, the whole thing, because it has to be perfect. So when take it in tomorrow, isn't that horrible? I mean, yeah, for all my life, yeah. What can I tell you? So this Tommy, I felt so sorry for him. He's not too bright. How did you create him? And why did he only want to help get into Hoyt's good graces? This poor kid was brainwashed.
Mm-hmm.
He's a cool character, too.
Well, thanks. You know, it's very hard to answer how a character develops for me. In other words, I knew I needed a fence. Tommy is a fence, and he fences all Francis's route. And so I needed someone, and so I created Tommy. And Tommy's very insecure. He's the kind of person who wants to please everyone, but also, and he admires Francis. I mean, Francis is the best at what he does, and so he's admirable. And Tommy does want to stay in his good graces, but there's also a very economic reason why, is that Hoyt steals high-end silver now, which means
mm-hmm.
that he can get a lot of money for it. And so Tommy is beholden to Hoyt to keep supplying him with the stolen goods. And so that's why he puts up with a lot of Francis's derogatory remarks and sort of bullying him a little bit. And that's really why he wants to please, for the two reasons, is he really wants, people like being around people who are successful, the flunkies.
Mm-hmm.
Somehow they think that it makes them successful or it makes them better than they are. And Tommy is one of those people who wants to stay in the good graces of someone who he thinks not only can help him make a living, but is the best at what he does.
He is the best at what he does. But I was just wondering in the back of my mind, that same thing, he's a kid, and I'm surprised that he gave him all of this stuff and didn't steal any for himself so that he would have money to sell, because he's a fence.
Right.
Gary,
well, it's like they find out you've done something wrong, you don't get their business anymore.
And that's true, too. And then if Hoyt found out, he wouldn't be alive to find out any business anymore.
Right,
so,
right.
Well, we have, there are a lot of women in the world that like to be with guys that are very rich and they're not too bright. So we have Melinda and Evelyn. Why are they so dense? And with their relationship with him, but is it strictly money? Are they really loyal to him? They really think that he likes them that much? I mean, give me a break here. I knew right away.
Well, that point I've tried to make him, and I think he's very charismatic.
He is.
People like that. They emanate something, whether it's a sense of success or self-confidence or whatever. And I think that's it, more than the money. Yes, he lavishes money on them, but money is a form of control. So what he's really doing is controlling these women. These women, again, often they are they may have been abused at some point in their life. They are.
Mm-hmm.
They may have been belittled sometimes in their life, and here they're being being given attention to by someone of importance, someone who is arrogant, someone who is not afraid to tell you how good they are, someone who's in charge, and I think there's a certain charisma about people like that.
Yeah, there is something about them. It's like when I taught, I was the dean, and the barely bad kids were the most popular.
That's right.
The kids that were, the kids that got sent to my office, they weren't popular after they left. They weren't happy after they left. But, there were a group of them that, formed their own group posse. And then when the principal of the school said I was doing my job really well and no one was getting in trouble, she said, maybe you need to back off and let the teachers handle it. I said, you're going to be sorry you said that. So I took a week off. I never took a week off. Never took more than a day in 36 years. And when I came back, I knew I was going to pay the penalty because those kids wound up creating their own posse of terror, which I had to stop. And I'm little.
Right.
And think their characters, they're great, right?
Well, Fran, think about the sitcom Happy Days. Who's the most popular character in Happy Days, Richie or Fonzie?
Fonzie, because he was charismatic and because he was tough,
right.
But he never, he did bad things, but not really. But I loved Fonzie.
Well,
was the greatest.
He was within the context of a TV show, a sitcom, so he couldn't do bad things.
Yeah.
look at the way he was dressed, like the tough guy in school,
mm-hmm.
and he was most popular. He'd snap his finger and women would come. So that's just a microcosm of what life is like in many cases.
Yeah, these kids were tough, except when they looked at me and they said, "She's going to get us." As a matter of fact, there were like about 10 of them, and I straightened them out. And I've never did this before. At the end of the year, I said to the principal, "These five need to learn a lesson that they're never going to forget." I said, "So when graduation comes, they get to sit in the back. They don't get to march." I never did that before. And I thought long and hard, and I said to the parents, "Up to you." Well, actually, it was up to me, whether they walked down the aisle. And they kept them home because they said I was right. They said, not because they weren't smart and didn't pass, but because for causing all the havoc when I was out or whenever I wasn't around to run around like a crazy lady to stop them, they stayed home. And I don't know if it made an impression or if they cared, but it made a big difference to everybody else that they weren't there. So we've got Manny and Charlie. Manny was suspended. So why does he think he deserved to be suspended from the police force?
Because he did something wrong, and he owns up to it. And
that's rare.
You know, that's part of his character. And that's the difference between he and Floyd. If Floyd did the same thing, and it wasn't a horrible thing, but if he did the same thing, he would feel that if he was punished for it, that he didn't deserve it. Whereas Manny is ashamed that he's broken a rule.
Well, a lot of people that are criminals, that like him, that justifies what he does, is not going to say, "Yeah, it's not okay. You know, what can I say? I didn't mean to do it, and I deserved it." No, he's not going to ever say that. That wouldn't be Francis White. That wouldn't even be Tommy. He was like, "Yeah, they deserved it, whatever." So when they finally realize that he's on and he's robbing, how do they decide, and who's going to help them? And who helps besides Tommy helps Floyd? Anybody else? Because his girlfriend's really, like, what can I say?
Well, he's a bit of a loner, too. He doesn't trust people.
Yeah.
You know, he doesn't trust Tommy. He doesn't trust the women. He doesn't trust anyone. He's an island to himself.
Smart.
You know, this is the way he's always been.
That's probably why he gets away with it.
That's right. He uses people. People are there to be used by Francis Hoyt.
And I think in their hearts, these girls knew it, but didn't want to face it. And even when faced with the fact that there was someone else and they may not be the only one, they didn't care. They didn't want to believe it anyway. They want, well, I guess all the money that he gave them and showered them with, you know, that pays, that negates all the negative, I guess, when it comes to them.
Well, it's attention. It's a form of attention, and these women probably haven't had attention paid to them throughout their lives.
Well, when questioning his girlfriends, what do you want readers to understand about both of these? And what lesson can be learned from falling for someone like Hoyt? But I don't know if they ever learned the lesson, but what lesson should be learned? Like, don't be so naive, people.
Well, they should learn that these men are really not seeing who they are. These men are using them in many instances. And I'm talking about a specific kind of man and a specific kind of woman. Something I have a lot of empathy and sympathy for these women because the women haven't had it easy. And, you know, it's not all the stuff in the news now we see, and men should see that it's not easy to be a woman. You're much more vulnerable at every moment of the day, no matter what you do. If you put a man in a situation and a woman in a situation, a woman is going to be more vulnerable. So these women are, and a lot of men take advantage of that, as we've seen in the news.
Mm-hmm.
And Hoyt is one of the men who takes advantage of women. He would also take advantage of men, too. He's an equal opportunity abuser. It's all about him. He's a narcissist.
Well, that's easy to tell. But deep down, do you think that Evelyn and Melinda realize that he's using them? Or they just didn't want to face it because of all the money? Yeah, they couldn't be that dumb, really.
I they're not dumb women at all. They're not dumb.
Yeah, no, they just choose to just not care. Yeah.
That's right. And you know something? It's not only dumb women, it can be some very, very smart, intelligent, brilliant
yeah.
women who get taken
yeah.
advantage of by men.
Well, they want to feel needed, I guess, because no one else does.
Right.
So this was interesting. Manny's wife was upset. Why didn't she want him to investigate Hoyt? What was her reasoning? Because after a while, she realizes that's not a good idea.
Well, you know something, I try to put myself in the place of a wife of a mm-hmm. of a police person or anyone who is, you know, in law enforcement. And it must be every single day when your husband or boyfriend or son goes off to work, there's a possibility that they may not come back. And so she, first of all, he's going to be away from her. They live in Miami, and most of the book takes place in the north, in New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut. And he's going to be away from home, and they have kids, and so she doesn't really want him to do this. But he feels it's an obsession with him is to bring Francis Hoyt to justice.
But yet she sticks with him. She's not getting a divorce. She's not going to, you know, drop
right.
him. I know. He's lucky that she's loyal. He's lucky that she's loyal to his wife. But in some cases, they might not be. In some of the books that I've just read, too many of them, where the wife says, I can't deal with this. Your career is more important than I am, and have a nice life. I need
right.
something else. So
right.
she hasn't said that yet, and hopefully she won't, because she's a good character, too. So what happens when Charlie comes face-to-face with Hoyt? And when he gets away with everything. We know that. But what happens when they come face-to-face? How does he deal with that?
Well, I knew, you know, I'm the kind of writer, friend. I don't plan anything out. I go
mm-hmm.
page to page. So I never know what's going to happen. But I knew that at some point, these rivals would have to come face-to-face.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted them to do it, oddly enough, not on Charlie Floyd's terms, but on Francis Hoyt's terms. So what I think you're alluding to is actually a very important scene in the book.
Mm-hmm.
Charlie Floyd lives in Connecticut. He has a home in Connecticut. And Manny Perez has come up from Florida and is staying in the house in an extra bedroom with Charlie Floyd. So they're living together. And almost two-thirds of the way through the book, maybe a little bit more even, I thought it's time that these two people face each other.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had Francis Hoyt show up at the doorstep of Charlie Floyd. He comes to his home. And the reason is I wanted the most serious kind of confrontation. And sort of a, you know, it's an intrusion, is to go to someone's home unannounced and
mm-hmm.
show up. And that I thought was very in character of Hoyt. He's so arrogant, he's going to go and he's going to knock on the door. He knows that Floyd and Perez are after him. He doesn't care. He's going to go there and taunt them by showing up at their doorstep. And I think that's the confrontation that you're talking about. And it's really a
yeah.
turning point in the book. So I don't want to give away, because there's something that happens there that really does
mm-hmm.
turn the book around. But that is a very important confrontation between the two.
Yeah, it was. It was stressful for me, too. I got tense there.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't know exactly how it was going to be handled, but we're not going to tell anybody what happened. So
right.
then we have Hoyt's mother. Now, a lot of criminals' parents are afraid of them because they're afraid to rat out their own son because they're afraid they're going to hurt them or do something evil, and besides the fact that he pays her way. So what happens when they come to talk to her? She doesn't want to answer anything.
Well, you know something? This to me, I'm not a mother and never will be, but there's something
mm-hmm.
about motherhood that is...
Mm-hmm.
is all-consuming and all-blind. So if you, in real life, you sometimes the reporters or whatever will go to the mothers of a criminal, And the mothers will have a totally different view of their child than reality. And so the mothers are protective, and it's her baby,
mm-hmm.
it's her son, no matter what he's done. And there is this all-consuming motherly love that mothers have, and thank goodness they do. But you often see this. I often think about it. You have these people who commit horrendous crimes, but their mothers still love them and still support them and probably wouldn't, in most cases, turn them in if they could. And so I wanted to create a character who I thought, in her own way, she's really laudable
mm-hmm.
by protecting her son. I mean, we would think, oh, you know, why doesn't she turn him in, you know, for the good of society?
Mm-hmm.
It's still her son. And so that's the way I wanted her to behave. She knows that he's not, you know, that he's breaking the law. She prefers not to deal with that, and to see him as her baby who was abused by her husband, his father. And so she has a lot of sympathy and empathy for him.
Well, if you listen to the news sometimes, when you see these parents of children that killed somebody or hurt them, oh, he's a good kid, he would never do that.
That's
and
right.
Even though you can see in their faces, you know, I read Mark Broughton wrote a book, FBI agent Mark Broughton wrote How to Tell a Lie by the FBI, and my brother-in-law grabbed it out of my hand when I was done. But I do remember the different ways that you can tell if somebody's lying. And I look at these people, and I could tell. If they don't look you straight in the eye while they're talking, you know they're full of baloney. And you can tell, you know, by the tone of their voices that they're defending someone that they know is wrong, but yet they're not going to admit that their child is ever wrong. My mother would never admit my brother was ever wrong either, but he didn't do anything. Me, on the other hand, that's another story. What can I say? So,
right.
this I found amusing. Why does Manny call Charlie Floyd and call him by his full name? My mother used to do that to me when she got mad. She called me by my full name, which it was so long that I couldn't spell it on a paper. It was like 40 letters long. So why does he
right.
call him Charlie Floyd?
Well, it's actually, for him, it's a form of respect. It's a formal way of addressing someone, and that to him is respectful. And there's only one person in my life who has done that with me, and that is Susie Essman, the comedian who's on the Larry David Show, Curb Your Enthusiasm.
Mm-hmm.
Ever Susie sees me, she'll use my whole name. She'll say Charles Salzberg. How are you, Charles Salzberg? And that kind of stuck with me because we don't do that, you know. But for Manny, it's a form of respect.
No, when anybody calls me till this day, I changed my name and I made it shorter. So if there's only one lady that used to come to my hairdresser that called me by my full name and I just let her get away with it, that and my third grade teacher that just passed away. She was allowed to also. Actually, she turned out to be my first boss. So what happened that he spent 2 years in prison, and what mistake would White never make again? Because you learn from your mistakes. You learn the first time, and then you don't do it again. Well, at least
That's
you
right.
hope you don't.
And he does. Early on in his career, when he was getting a reputation for being as good as he is, and when something we haven't mentioned is that he, in the beginning of his career, he was a second story man. He'd go up to the second floor and steal the valuables.
Mm-hmm.
And what happens is he's pressured at one point in his career. He's pressured. He's the mob realizes how good he is, and they want to take advantage of it. So they make it so that he has to take someone along with him, someone else. Now, he's used to working alone. And his instinct says, you know, nothing good can come of this if I work with someone else. But he's pressured into it by the mob. And so he takes on someone to come with him. And this someone, Hoyt is never armed. He doesn't carry a weapon because he doesn't want to have to use it. And he doesn't. And he's arrogant enough to think that he will never have to use it. Unfortunately, this guy that he's pressured into taking along with him does carry a weapon, and they are discovered in the act of stealing from someone, from a homeowner who happens to find them upstairs stealing. And so the fellow with Hoyt pulls out his gun and shoots the homeowner. The homeowner is not killed, but he's wounded. And that changes the crime, and it also changes the attention of the authorities. And so, and also there's someone else that they can track down. And so the authorities do track down this other guy, and he, you know, rolls over on Hoyt, and that's why Hoyt goes to prison, because he made a mistake of taking someone along, not because he made a mistake of, you know, during the robbery. And the truth is, I mean, this is just speculation on my part, but I created the character, is if that guy wasn't with him, he never would have been caught in the act, and there would have been no violence, obviously. And if he were caught in the act, because he has been, there's one story about him being seen by a child, but he can handle those things because he keeps his head. So that's what gets him into prison, someone else's mistake, not his.
Okay,
and
before I forget, because I don't want to forget, it's in front of me, maybe. I'm going to do something different next Wednesday. Minister Sam Oliver and I have become friends on Facebook. He's been on my show before. And because of what's going on in the world and in general and in life in general, I decided that it's time we did a show on understanding, tolerance, forgiveness, and kindness. And who better than to talk about it than Sam Oliver, and he thinks my questions are right on point. On January 4th, Pastor Michael Jones, if you might see him on Facebook, Beginning to Serve, talked about some of the things that he wrote in his book. And although I'm Jewish and he wrote about, you know, Christian things, we didn't talk about the religious part. We talked about the lessons that were learned. And it was really, really interesting. On the 5th, one of my favorite people from Scotland, Alex Gray, will be here, Silent Games. Someone you might know on the 9th, John Lansing, the 4th gunman. On the 11th, the author of The Fixed. And because my book, A Daughter's A Promise, is out there. I wish more people would read it and buy it. I'm doing a special show this Thursday to talk about caregiving and my promise never to put my mom in a nursing home. Now, that was my choice and my family's. Irene Brodsky is dealing with it, and her husband's in a nursing home. We're going to talk about elder care abuse and what she's dealing with. And Marcia Casper Cook will be here and talk about the home, what she dealt with her mom in Chicago. So that should be very interesting, and I'm very proud to say that hopefully this week my new caregiver's guide will be out on Amazon in print and an ebook, and it's called Because We Care, for caregivers, and it's for people that deal with elder care abuse, traumatic brain injury, which took my sister besides heart, and Alzheimer's. And that's just some of what Fran's up to. So, how would you describe Manny in relation to why he wants this guy in prison so bad? And why does he think that he and Charlie can actually get him? They're sure that they're going to get him this time.
Yes, the reason he wants to keep him in, to put him in prison so badly is, again, it has to do with Manny's concept of law and order and fairness.
Mm-hmm.
Manny, we haven't actually mentioned this, but Manny is Cuban, and he came to the country when he was a teenager.
Mm-hmm.
So he really he loves America. He really appreciates America and what they've done and what they've allowed him to become, which is they allowed him into the country. And they allowed him to live here and earn a living. And his way of repaying them was to become a cop, to uphold law and order. And so Francis Hoyt is an anathema to that. He is breaking the law. And so to Manny, that's a personal affront, because this is a country that he loves, and here's someone who is breaking the law, this country that he loves. And so that's why he is so ardent and trying to catch Hoyt. And I don't want to give away why he was suspended, but it has to do with Hoyt. And so there's a little bit of payback in Manny too about catching him. And the reason he thinks that that he and Charlie Floyd can bring him to justice is because he believes that Charlie Floyd, just like Hoyt does, believes he's the best at what he does, and he is extremely good. And the other thing about him, about Charlie Floyd, and this comes from Devil in the Hole. In Devil in the Hole, Floyd is after someone who has murdered his entire family, and he doesn't give up. He stays on this case for years. And Manny knows that he stayed on this case for years because he came down to Florida to check out a lead, and that's how he and Manny met. And so Manny really believes that if he teams up with Floyd, he's teaming up with the best and someone who will not give up, someone who is obstinate and someone who will stick with it to the very end. And so that's why I believe that that Manny believes that this is going to happen. This is fated. They are going to find him, and they are going to put him in jail.
Well, at least in his own mind. I don't know, a lot of police officers, you know, think the same way, and what's happening in the world, and that's so sad. I did a show 2 weeks ago with someone you know, Alan Jacobson and Michael Embry, and we talked about Parkland, because my niece's school was locked down the same day, and they did have a bomb. They did have an officer that shot himself by accident, so they had to lock down the school, and Katie texted me to let me know. And my other niece, Carly, her school had a bomb threat the same day, and they had helicopters and dogs and everything. So every single morning I text both of them to make sure they're okay. And I said to them, if you see something, say something, and if you can't get your parents, even though we're in New York, I know how to dial 911. So they got that loud and clear, because it's scary. So we have Hoyt. I love this guy. I'm sorry. If Hoyt could speak, what is his opinion of Charlie and Manny? And does he really think he's that smart that he's going to go keep on outsmarting them?
He absolutely thinks he's that smart. I mean, that's what drives him. It's not just the money he makes. It's that he's the best. He has to be the best. And that, again, is one of the themes of the book, is that always needing to be the best has consequences. There are consequences of doing that. And you will at some point, you will push the envelope too far and something will happen. And that's the sort of the theme of this book, is that there are consequences to always having to be the best and always be a winner. And, you know, I don't want to get into politics now, but we have a president has that that attitude, is you're either a winner or a loser. Well, that's not true. You're not, you know, someone who loses can lose with grace. They can lose with the best effort that they've taken, and they should not be dismissed simply because they have lost. There really is, in a way, no such thing as a loser, as far as I'm concerned. If you've done your best, if you play a game, sports or something, everyone wants to win. You have done your best. There's honor in that as well. So that, to me, is really what this book is about, is a refutation of that sense that you have to be the best.
No, I agree with you, because I watched baseball games that my nephews were in, and when my brother was coaching, it was, so if you win or lose, don't worry about it, just congratulate the other team, whereas some coaches said, you lost, I'm going to take care of this, this is unacceptable, and then some kids feel like, I don't think I want to do this anymore, I don't want to play anymore. And you can be the best as long as, like you said, you're the best that you can be, and you don't have to be perfect. It's hard, let me tell you, to live up to your own reputation at times. I think the only person that defended me growing up, besides my grandfather, was my grandmother. And she would say, the kid is an A average. What do you want? And she came from Europe, and I taught her how to read because she couldn't read. And she said, but she's so smart. No, she's got to do it exactly right. What can I say? I'll tell you, I graduated with my third master's from Manhattan College, and the last test I took, my mother picked me up from school, and she said, where's the test that you just got? I go, wait, how did you know that? Did the professor call you? She said, well, you got 99. I said, yep, no, I did. I got 110 because they gave extra credit, and I was the only one that passed. So she kept quiet. Didn't matter. I said, and by the way, the only reason I got 99 is because I accidentally didn't see the question over there, and I left one out. She's like, excuse me, how could you do that? I go, not easy. What can I say? So why did they want Hoyt? This is strange. I mean, all criminals know. I mean, all the people on the news know the police are after me. They're going to get me, or maybe they're not. And there's a serial killer in Tamarack, and unfortunately they haven't gotten him. There was one right in my neighborhood 2 weeks ago that shot his girlfriend because she cheated on him or something. They had to lock down all the schools up here, and they never got him. So why did they want Hoyt to know, we're going to get you, and that they're after him and that they think they know where he might be? Why did they let him know, yeah, you're in trouble, and we're going to get you? Not that he cares.
Because they know him so well that they know that or they're hoping that if he knows they're after him, he's going to up his game and that he's going to make a mistake. They are taunting him because they want him to make a mistake.
Well, I can understand that. So being, you know, growing up and knowing that I had to be perfect, at this point in my life, nothing unnerves me and nothing intimidates me. I learned. But even kids today, even grown-ups today, don't always say, okay, I'm going to do this and think about the consequences and what's happening next. And obviously, Hoyt still doesn't think that there's any consequences of his actions. So how did you create the creative ending? I'm not going to say cool.
Well, I don't want to get, obviously, and you don't either, into what it is.
No, no,
but I got
no.
to the end, as I do with every book. And endings, I don't know for other writers, but endings are the toughest thing for me because I don't like to have pat endings. I don't like to have predictable endings. And so when I got to the end, I didn't want it to be predictable. And again, I'm not going to say what I did, but that's the reason. For that ending is I wanted to do the opposite of what people might think was going to happen.
It was so clever. I just cracked. I said, oh my God, if anyone, oh my God, that was so clever. So if Hoyt could speak to listeners, what would he tell them about Charlie and about Manny? What would he say? I just love this guy. I'm sorry.
Well, he would... He believes that they are going to lose, that they're not going to find him, and they're not going to stop him. And so that's what he would probably call them fools for even trying. You know, that's his arrogance. And yet he respects them. He knows. Mm-hmm. In a way, Fran, it's a compliment to him that two really good cops or investigator are coming after him. That means he's important enough he's special. You know, not everyone has, two really good people trying to bring them down. And so, in a way, that's a badge of courage, but it also means that it's a challenge to him. If the best can't beat him, then he must be the best, right? So so that's why he feels about them. He's actually, he'd never say it, but he's actually honored that they're after him. It's a challenge.
Well, my husband watches Dexter, which I can't take, and he gets away with it until he decides at the end he doesn't want to get away with it anymore. But I don't think Charlie Hoyt, Frank Hoyt is going to ever give himself up. You know, they're going to have to literally hogtie him if they ever catch him. So before we end, we have about 3 minutes, whatever, and Mike has to come back on. Hi, computer. It's nice to see you again. Where can we learn more about you and your work and what's next? And are you coming to the Thriller Fest so I could say hi?
To the first question, or to one question, what I'm working on next, I'm trying to finish now, is another Swan, the fifth Swan.
Oh, cool.
I thought I was only going to write four, but I got an idea for a fifth, so I'm writing it. And then I have to write a short story for someone's anthology. Where they can find they find me at home, but I obviously won't give my address. But if you go to charlessalzberg.com, you can find me there. You can find me on Facebook. Just type in my name. And also, I have a very cool site called henryswan.com, and Swan is with two N's. And if you go to that site, there are some videos that friends of mine made for the site. So, and that's for all the Henry Swan books. So that's where, and people can find me on Twitter, too. I'm not a big Twitter user, but I'm on Twitter.
I'm everywhere. I'm in too many places.
I know.
As a matter of fact, you know, it's really weird. I got an email this morning from people I have no idea who they are, asking me if I want to review for them instead of reviewing for everybody else. They'll get me books. So I got all excited because I said, I can't review for you. What a pity. You only have digital. And they said, in your case, we'll make an exception. Go like,
what?
Whatever. I didn't agree. I have 40 books inside staring at me.
Oh, wow.
I do have Alex Berenson's book. And I hope I get to it soon. For those of you that want to know what to read, Second Story, man. And Passover is this weekend. I take presents when people come to visit me because I'm doing Passover in two different ways. Half my family celebrates, the other half doesn't. So we're going to have a little bit of both, Easter and Passover on Saturday, which should be fun. Brian Freeman's Alter Ego, you got to read it. It's too much. The Voice Inside. And somebody that you know, KJ Howe, Kim, is going to be on my show on Skyjack on April 26th. I am totally honored that she wants to do this. And I am thrilled that you came on my show. And I hope that, are you coming to the Thriller Fest this year?
To which one? Oh, Thriller Fest?
The Thriller Fest, yeah.
Yeah, I might stop by. You know, I'm in the city, so I might stop by. But before I go, Fran, I just want to thank you. Not just for having me on all these times, but for being such a supporter of authors and for books. You know, we need that now is you know, more than ever, I think, reading mm-hmm. books. And you're really great having your show. And, again, thank you so much for having me on.
Thank you so much. I know something, in case anybody doesn't know, seriously, the other day I went to one of the urgent cares. I have to go back this afternoon because the doctor said, we need to make sure you're okay. Besides, I have to bring them books. I'm not allowed to come without books. And he wants yours, by the way. Yeah, and he wanted to know, he said to me, how much do you get paid to do a review? Nothing. Why?
Yeah.
I said, because it's unethical to ask money for your opinion. And he just looked at me and he just said, you've got to be kidding. I said, I know this Kirkus, Publishers Weekly, and they write editorial reviews, and a Kirkus review is $485 to $700, depending on how many words you want. I said, I'll give you as many words as you want, and I won't charge you. He said, well, what do you get paid for your radio show? I said, I don't. I pay the network, whatever. And it's funny because the network, Blog Talk Radio, has asked me several times to pay more money every month because they think that I should do three-hour shows instead of two. I don't think so. But they think that what I'm doing is great. And for those listening, let me tell you, the show is being taped and recorded for quality assurance. And the reason I don't do a chat room is because about 4 or 5 months ago, there were people in the chat room that were totally ignorant and didn't understand what we were talking about. And my very blunt statement to them that they could hear was, if you don't like the topic, you don't like my show, you could disconnect because I really don't care. And they did. And I reported it to Blog Talk Radio and said that they would look into it and drop them because they don't want negativity either. So this has been fun. And when is the next one coming out? So I have you with my pencil, you and my schedule over here.
Well, I actually have a book coming out in September called Strike 3.
Good birthday. Thank you.
Oh, it's called Strike 3, and it's another collection of three it's an anthology of three crime novellas with my pals Ross Clavin and Tim O'Mara, and that'll be out in September. And it's a sequel to Triple Shot, which was the first book.
I read that.
I love that one. Thanks. And this is another one. So there'll be three crime stories in that. And then the next Swan will be out next January, I think.
Well, I'm putting it down in my little folder over here so that I don't forget. I am planning on my last show for this season, maybe, might be May 29th, but I might do one more in June, like the first week, and then Fran is taking time off because my nephew's graduating from high school in June, and he's demanded my attention for a couple of days. He wants his aunt's presence because he said I'm fun and I'm not boring, which is really cool.
Yeah.
Of an 18-year-old that wants his aunt to come. Well, he knows I'm going to sit in the stands and yo, Jake, you're the best one, because I'll, you know, scream and yell and carry on, where his parents will just sit there so subdued. It's no fun to be boring. So I'm thinking about doing a show on endings, talking about how authors have the, create their endings and how they create, whether they create in multiple voices or they just write each scene. See, to me, I wonder sometimes if somebody is writing in multiple voices, do you just keep writing? Where some authors write the one voice, then they go to back to the next one, then the next one, and they just write each person, and they come see where it fits, and sometimes it doesn't fit. So I may consider doing that, like, the first week of June. So would you consider doing something like that in
sure.
the panel?
Sure.
Oh, okay, good. I'll pencil you in. And I'm going to come up with a date. And I figured the other person I might ask is maybe Brian Freeman, because some of his endings are kind of weird. And maybe John Land, because you know John Land. And John Land will be here on May 3rd. John Land is the new Jessica Fletcher. That's all I'll say, A Date with Murder. And his new book is A Date with Murder. And he wrote the latest Jessica Fletcher murder. He's taken over. I have to tell you, it's fantastic. So
cool.
Thank you so – yeah, it is cool. Thank you so very much. I hope to see you in July in the Thriller
okay.
Fest. Everybody have a great day. It's not snowing. It's beautiful outside. Have a nice great day, and bye.
Thanks.